We're in the belly of the beast in East London, in Hornsliff Studio.
Yeah, and here we have the A12 leading to actually down to Canary Wharf that way. And to that way on the left we have Hackney Wick, and over there we have Bow. So and actually the Olympic Stadium right over there, 500 meters from here. And the noise here is the vibrant London night traffic. And now we are in front of this big studio, which is about, 500 square meters? And it's dark. Can you find the light? So, welcome to the future Hornsleth Institute of Radical Humanism. But this is... Right now we're just kind of moving in here, we're redecorating, we're making toilets up here. And what you see here is a huge space, like 20 by 15 meters and 10 meters to the ceiling. And we have a balcony all the way around, like each 6 meters wide. And in the middle we have a hole which is 10 by 20 meters. And it looks like almost like a cathedral, eh? No, if you don't have anything to say, then it's part of the radio.
I'm more worried about what I can and can't say.
You can say anything you want. It's Danish radio. There's no fucking censorship there. It's not like fucking Britain, is it?
Yeah, but there's a lot of rules in Britain.
Why?
And I don't want to trip up on rules.
Are you going to... Yeah, okay. Grant, what is this about? What do you want to do here?
Well, it's the platform for... It's a marketing thing, really, that... Basically, it's an underground movement that from here, everybody in London who's important to touch are going to come through here and feel the vibe of the place. It's basically a cultural hub for the underground. There's so much bureaucracy in London that we have to be careful what we say for what the reasons this building's being used for, which is why I didn't want to speak before.
Is that the client? Okay.
So take it.
Jeg hedder Christian von Hornsleth, og jeg er billedkunstner, og jeg opererer i London og delvis København. Og lige nu er vi i mit nye værksted, som jeg kører sammen med en engelsk filminstruktør her, Grant Alexander. Og vi er her midt i East London, i det, der hedder Bow-Hackney, lige ved siden af Olympiske Stadion, i 500 kvadratmeter. Stor sal, som I kan høre, og der er to etager. Hvor der er balkoner rundt omkring, og her bliver der så meningen, der skal laves kunstevents og forskellige aktiviteter. Og vi har nogle forskellige stadier, fordi det er meget, meget kostbart at køre det. Så har vi forskellige indtægtskilder. Vi har fotostudier, vi skal være bygge op her, og der bliver lavet skråvægge og bøjet vægge og lyssætninger. Og så bliver der lavet events, der bliver lavet store fester og raves. Der bliver alle mulige mærkelige indtægtskilder. Men på lang sigt handler det om at skabe et sted, hvor vi kan... in platform to udbrede vores egen kunst. But Grant, as you were saying before, the what's the long-term intention here? I just want to coordinate what I said.
Well, firstly, the first year spent in London, like I said to you, it's better to have 20,000 people who are the right people to know about Hornsliff rather than a million people who are completely the wrong people. And London's a very stuffy place, and we're in a very conservative area, so we went back to the grimiest, the street level, to find the urban vibe of the city. And that's why we come here. And the thing with the Hornsliff Studio is that it's a cultural hub where there's raves and there's parties and there's eccentric artists and people coming through all the time and ideas in a melting pot. And that's why we moved here. And that's what this studio is really about. It's not just about the art that's being created, it's about the ideas that are pushed around in here. And money.
Mm.
My baby wants to rock and roll.
It's a very wonderful acoustic in here. Acoustic. I love it. What's next? What's next? Now, right now, we are in the process of making it work, technically, putting up equipment, lamps, walls, getting people activated in the environment, and hopefully in a few months we were like totally 100% running. And actually it's like a travel. We don't know actually where it's going to lead us. And that's part of the excitement, I think. We don't know where it's going. But if you put two crazy minds together like this, things happen all the time. We already did a lot of strange events around London. So now we're trying to focus energy on one area and really push it. Let's go to the apartment then. Have a chat.
Mikrofonholder er i London i selskab med den danske billedkunstner Christian von Hornslet og hans engelske makker og roommate Grant Alexander. Grant er filminstruktør og skildrer det engelske klassesamfund. Han er selv vokset op i slumkvarteret Graham Park i Nordvest London og ud af en familie, hvor to af hans brødre er misbrugere. Den ene er nu død, det samme er hans far, som blev skudt for år tilbage.
So now we are in the in my apartment in East London with my good friend and partner in projects, Grant Alexander, filmmaker and troublemaker in the East End of London. We met almost 2 years ago in while I was trying to put up a show in central London, and what amazed me in the beginning was always that I met so many British people, and they're always full of shit, sorry to say it, but they always have these second agendas. They're all lying and they flaky, and they didn't say when they were coming. And as being a sort of a Viking in where the word is important, I get very sad about the fact that nobody seems to care about each other. And then this guy comes along, which is very British and very English, and he speaks directly language. If you ask an opinion, you get it right in your face, which is I found very un-British, but it is. And why do you think it's like that? Why did you remember when we talked about the first time? The first time we actually talked, we talked about where this comes from, this flakiness.
That's poverty.
Yeah.
The flakiness comes from the class system and from hidden agendas. I just think you're talking about an England that I don't know. The England that you talk about is not the England that I know. I know the England, the street, and from the poor areas. And when you haven't got anything, all you've got is your word. So you're talking about a bond and an honour. Where I come from, that's where our honour is, in the word. But you're talking about the upper class of England, where everything is cut your throat for money and lies. And that's what your big mistake was, that you were dealing with the art establishment and dealing with the upper classes, who only follow what the lower class set anyway. All the fashion and all the trends are dictated by the street and by poverty and by struggle. All those people that you're talking about to me are the people who follow the street anyway, once it's established. And for me, you know, you were completely speaking to the wrong people.
Yeah, because one of the things that really provoked me when I came over here in 2009 was that I had an idea in my head that, because I lived here in the 70s when I was a kid with my parents, and I had this dream image of England. I had a very good time and memory from that time in 71, 72, and we lived outside here and around Hampton Court, and we had a good time. When I came back here, I saw these crazy big class differences, and which has inspired me to think, why doesn't democracy work at all here? What's happening? I was thinking, if they want to get rid of these systems, why don't they just vote some people in that will fight for them? Why does poor people vote Labour here? That was my question. And what did you say?
Well, there is no Labour here. Labour are not Labour. Labour are just another branch of the Conservative Party. You know, the unions were squashed. The Labour Party was crushed. There was no socialist movement. There was no working people's movement after the 80s. It was completely crushed. There's no democracy. There's two parties that are ideologically the same, who basically every few years we choose between this party and that party, that are basically the same party, because all the union and all the people's movements were crushed and nobody has any faith in the system whatsoever. And that's what we're left with. To you, you're used to a system where the people fought and struggled and protected the unions and protected people's movements. And that's something that you have. Here we don't. That's gone. It's gone 25 years ago. And now we're left with one option. Conservative or Labour. And they're the same option, you know?
So you say there was a movement like that before. Well,
The unions tried to fight Thatcher in the 80s and they were crushed. You know, they were absolutely obliterated. And since then, all the unions have collapsed and everything's been privatised.
No, yeah, I know. We know that. But why did it happen? How can they convince people with no money to vote non-socialistic?
Well, I don't know. There was a point where Thatcher was going under, you know, and what happens when a politician's going under? Wage war. And that's what happened. Thatcher was about to be kicked out and then wage war. We went into the Falklands War. Suddenly there was a swing. Thatcher was re-elected on a wave of patriotic, you know, fervour. And the next thing you knew, everybody was pro-Thatcher. At that point, the power that she gained through there, they crushed the unions over the next election. And we haven't looked back, really, you know. The people's parties have all been crushed. There is no representation for the people. We're left with, you know, two parties. There's no democracy. That's what leads you to the Acquire Democracy project, you know?
Yeah, we're working on a project now, which is, the working title is the Acquire Democracy, and it's about, it's kind of an art performative project, and it's about convincing people in Britain and other places in the world that to sell their vote to a art project, meaning that if, let's say, you're selling your vote, we would make a painting of you, which states whoever owns my portrait owns my vote. So you will sell that painting to some rich guy, and he will by contract between you and the buyer, you will vote according to what your owner wants you to vote. And actually, this is going to be turned into a documentary film where I actually visit people in certain areas. And it's not only poor areas, but it's one of the first areas that we try to focus on is a place you know very well. And you kind of found out what's going on in this part of... you grew up there, I seem to remember.
Yeah, Grand Park, you're about.
Yeah, and then you talk about this pub.
Well, to go back, to me, it's not very controversial. It's not shocking. To every Dane that the idea is floated with, it's like, why would you abandon your rights to vote? To me and to the people from where I grew up, it's not a question of why we would. It's how much can we get for it? This is brilliant. Your vote means nothing. It's worthless. Give me the fucking money. Take my vote. They don't care. I don't understand what's so controversial about it. I floated the idea with my family, and every single person said straight away, I'll give up my democratic freedoms for money, because they're worthless anyway, you know? And I think that's the view of England that I know, that's outside of the square mile of London, you know, the business centre. Outside, everyone else is disillusioned. Nobody cares about their vote. To you guys, it's something sacred, you know, because you fought for it, it seems, and it pays dividends. Here, we were crushed and we had no options. So what does giving our vote away mean? It means nothing. And through the documentary is clearly going to reflect that as soon as we go into working class areas and you see people try to steamroll through the door just to sell their vote. Hmm. It's going to be a circus. Nobody cares about their vote.
And actually, we already have buyers for it. There are certain people think it's great to have a poor person depicted on a painting in his house, and then he can say, "Oh, I own this guy, I own his vote." And it sounds very cynical, but it's hopefully raising a question about what art can be, and can art change anything? And
I think it's asking a bigger question than that. It's asking, how did we get to this point in England? For me, that's the question. How did we get to the point where people in other countries will fight and riot for just the hope to vote, where we'll fight and riot for the hope to sell our vote? I think that's the question it begs to me. Why? How did we get to this point?
And that leads to back to what we are doing with our big new studio / institute of radical humanism in across the street. We are we need to create a platform from where we can do our projects, and we need a workplace and an environment where we can meet people and do our thing, and it's all connected to a dream, and that dream will solidify itself as we go on, and hopefully I mean, when I think about it, the string of projects I'm trying to do, my artistic approach has kind of changed the last 10 years, because I when I began doing art, it was a pure, clean mirroring and reflection on what I saw. I saw something in the newspaper, I would just do some kind of reaction to it on a painting. And then, starting with the Africa project, I found out that art had no boundaries. It had you could do whatever you want as long as it's interesting. And these big projects, they were having more like a feature film aspect to it. It were more like epic, because they last several years. And first the Africa, and now the deep storage project, where we are collecting blood samples all over the world, and hopefully it's done by this fall, and then we can start the democracy project. But I really, when I came over here, I felt that. That there was a very, very much more openness to what I'm doing, when you saw the Africa project, you thought, "Why had nobody heard about it?" And remember what you said?
I said a lot of things. It's still a mystery to me why it didn't create, you know, bigger shockwaves than it did. For me, it's one of the best art pieces I've ever seen. You know, it works as a story, it works as a movie, but it works as a comment on aid. Good art should be a mirror to the world, you know. And that film, to me, puts a mirror to the world. It shows the problems with Africa. It shows our own hypocrisy towards aid. It shows our own abstraction from the issue, that people can get bogged down in something that means nothing, that's not tangible, just a name. Because our names mean something to us. To them, it means nothing. What they really care about is having fucking food for their children to eat. And people were bogged down talking about the ethics of it. To me, it's just a mirror to the world. It just shows exactly the ills of this world. The hypocrisy with the aid and all the bureaucracy. You know, when you gave relief and you gave aid in someone's hand, it was effective. As soon as you brought in layers of bureaucracy, the lawyer was the one layer of bureaucracy. What did he do? He stole the money. You know, it shows the problems there. But also, you know, we talk about aid. Aid isn't aid. Aid is a loan of some sort at massive interest, where we're going to rip resources back with the other hand. And that film was ripping something back. It was ripping something that wasn't tangible, that was just a name. You know, you actually gave aid and gave something took something superficial that had no tangible meaning. And to me, that shows, you know, the ills of this world as well, how people still, even when they see it so clearly, that transaction, still all they see is the superficiality of our world and the things that are important to us, like our name. They don't see the tangible importance of saving their lives. I thought it's a great piece. And the Acquired Democracy, you know, is the distant cousin of that. It's tackling another thing. I think the themes have become broader and more political. They were always political, whether people thought they were just pretty pictures of girls with their tits out. You know, they were political.
Mikrofonen holder i dag med den danske billedkunstner Christian von Hornslet og hans engelske makker og roommate Grant Alexander, som er filminstruktør. I 2006 lancerede Hornslet sit Uganda landsbyprojekt, som gik ud på at få en hel landsby til at tage hans efternavn, til gengæld for at få en gris. Dette vagte stor forargelse, og det er netop, hvad kunsten skal, mener de to. Den skal rejse spørgsmål. Lige nu arbejder de på et demokratiprojekt, der viser, at folk fra slumkvartererne er villige til at sælge deres stemme, hvis bare de får penge.
When you really think about it, how do you see your own work? I've read some of your scripts, I've seen some of your short films, very socially aggressive stuff. And where do you see our
the link?
Not the link, but the where do we any common ground?
I think the common ground is.
Can you just remember my first question? What did I just ask you about common ground? The next question I'll ask you after this will be, why do I love England so much and why do you hate it so much? But just ask the common, talk about the common ground first.
I don't know what your common ground is. I don't care what your common ground is. I only care what my ground with you is. I'm going to get to that. My common ground is that, you know, for me, films shouldn't have answers. They shouldn't be didactic. They shouldn't answer something. They should have raised questions. And the thing that I saw in the Uganda project was it raised questions. You know, it floated an idea. It floated an idea of what is aid, what are the hypocrisies of aid, what is our relationship to our own denial. It floated many questions with the deep sea storage. What is your link to now? What is your link to the future? It ponders questions of, you know, the future. Everybody sees it as something positive. I see it really as a warning. All of my projects seem to be the same thing. They seem to be about asking questions without supplying answers. And my projects have no common ground with Christian's projects, none whatsoever. But I think there is a link in terms of that questioning what you see around you, and don't take what is told to be the truth as truth just because somebody tells you it. Question it, peel it back, and, you know, make your opinions based on your own life experience. And with film, it's much more different. You know, it's for me, when I look at Christian's work, I instantly can explain Christian's work normally to him. Whereas with my own work, I think film is far harder to sort of explain that. It depends what you say. How do I do that? Without taking 30 minutes to do this, how do I do that within the scripts that we've worked on together? Mm. Well, firstly, I've never seen a film made in England set in the environment that we've set the story in. Christian didn't even know these places existed. When he saw them, he was like, this is in one of the leading countries in the world, the most developed countries in the world. This is like hell on earth. It's 2.5 miles of tower blocks all joined together, running parallel to each other with a prison inside that's an incubator for drugs and crime. You know, and when he walked in there, he was horrified by what he's seeing around. And that's because you don't traditionally see this. And he thought everyone in there was a junkie, a drug addict, a criminal. And it was a terrifying place to him. But I instantly took him to people who were drug dealers, who were criminals, who were what most people would look at as the scum of the earth, who were just born in an incubator of crime, and realised that these people have struggles and trials. And they're just the same as us. And instantly, as soon as you go into that environment and you see these people from the inside looking out, because it's a prison that they're in, and get inside the bars and look out, you instantly realise this system isn't built the way I thought it was built. This system's rigged for certain people. And inside this prison, once you get inside and you look out, it's a completely different view from the outside of the prison looking in. When I took him there for the first time, it was like he was in the outside the prison looking through the fence. As soon as you took him into the prison to look out through the fence, he had a different view on it. And that's where the common ground, I would suppose, with my films are. That they're set in a place
like,
that you don't see.
What is like 15 minutes in a car from here? It's right up your backyard. It's very, very strange to see totally wrecked areas so close to London Center. Very strange. And that's provoking for my spoiled social democratic Danish upbringing. You can see that we like taught that everybody should in theory have a chance to get an education and get going, and and you might laugh of it, but the idea about the Institute of Radical Humanism is exactly that what we're trying to do. And it might not help, it might help, we don't know, but if you make projects which are, like Grant says, raising questions, if you make projects that can raise the right questions, you can move things. And it might sound naive and might sound stupid, but I think somehow, and that's also where we differ a bit, but I think that in any artwork there is some kind of strange moral imperative to make the world a better place. And you always said,
I see it, totally.
You see that artwork is a pure exclamation of a existential, just a scream into the valley of a human being without any sociological intent.
No, I don't see it as having any hope or any meaning. You know, I don't. That's not the thing for me. It's just the doing. It's just mirroring it and showing it. I don't think a piece of art can change anything or anyone. You know, that's where we differ.
What can it do then?
The only thing it do is raise a question for you.
In order to do what?
In order to do what? There's many questions have been raised by pieces of art, but it hasn't changed anything for me. It's never changed me one bit. I'm sat here tonight talking about, you know, the abstraction of aid and how comfortable it is to ignore it. I'm fully aware of them issues, but I don't give a fuck about them issues.
But do you think after 20 of these projects, people might get better in Africa?
Look, I've worked with these projects and I'm aware of these projects and I'm aware of the reach of them. I don't give a fuck. We can't change any of it. Because the reason I do it is I would rather see the beauty of it actually shown and actually touch someone. But that's as far as you can move someone with a piece of art, is to maybe push them to the point of an emotional reaction to it. Well, they're not going to change anything. You know,
Tell me something completely different. When you remember we talked about music all the time, tell me what's the difference between Blur and Oasis?
Well, for me, the best art comes out of conflict and struggle. You know, you look at the difference between Blur and Oasis are that Blur were, you know, country boys working, doing A-levels and studying A-level music while Oasis were getting beaten by their dad and fighting in the streets and working on building sites. You know, there's a deeper meaning to their lives and to their struggles that comes out in the work, you know. And I think it's the same. That's why you talk about American pop music and British pop music, and it's because of the massive chasm with equality. You know, all of this stuff that comes out of America produces 99% shit. But because it's such an unequal society, when they produce something that's good, it's fucking good. Because it comes from conflict and struggle. You look at all the blues music, it came out of all of just the torture of blacks in the South. You take some of the greatest writers, they all come out of the South in America, out of terrible conditions. You look at any rock musicians, they come from shit, they come from horror. You know, great stories, great conflicts, great art comes from pain and struggle and conflict. And you talk about this sewing it up and cleaning it up. The only thing you can clean up with a piece of art is yourself. I don't think my piece of art is for anyone to clean up anything for anyone else. It's to clean my soul, not to clean anyone else's soul. You think that you can reach beyond that to someone else. I don't. I think it's purely for myself to clear my own mind and my own soul and my own experiences, you know, and that's the difference, I think, between the two of us. But
we also had a great fun about talking to the media. You seem to have a complete distrust to the BBC.
Oh, the BBC.
Why are we always looking at RT?
The BBC is a complete joke. You know, people talk about it as the most respected news organisation in the world. I went to a 500,000 people Stop the War in Gaza protest. It was shot at ground level with lots of TV cameras, all stationed at a strategically placed bottleneck outside the Israeli embassy. I was squashed with people and a barrier cracked a window. In order to stop people getting crushed, a group of us pushed it through the window. I saw on the BBC that night that, to quote, a small protest in London to stop the war in Gaza took place today that turned violent and ugly with scenes of vandalism and violence. It showed the pictures of us pushing the barrier through the window. I thought I was going home to see, you know, a groundbreaking march, never before seen amounts of people on the streets of London. The next day, there was a pro-Israel march. There was 150 people. It was shot on a crane from above to give it an elevated view to make it look like more people were filling the square. And they said on the news, many, many thousands of people turned out for a pro-Israel rally in London today. Too many people to count. I was there at both rallies. One was 150,000. One was less than 2,000. And the BBC dressed it up that the pro-Israel rally was bigger than the pro-Palestine rally. And that's happening 3 miles from BBC headquarters. If that's the shit they're touting, 3 miles from their own headquarters, I dread to think what they're touting from around the world. You know, that news organisation is worse than CNN, and it hasn't got any corporate sponsors. It might as well, because it's completely under the thumb of the Conservative government. The Conservative government have squashed the BBC. You know, they're in with Rupert Murdoch, and Rupert Murdoch's organisation wants to get hold of the Sky.
What's the hope for Britain, in your mind?
The only hope is that we can rob a few more countries and pillage a few more countries, much like you Vikings did, because we ain't getting out this hole without some real robbery.
I'm just talking about robbery. I just got robbed last week for like £7,000 from the Danish court system because I did this. You remember when you wrote that, when we talked about and we wrote that speech from that journalist in the Danish Politiken? And now we finally got a verdict from the district court, and it said that the rights to a photographer's photograph ranges much higher than the freedom of speech for an artist. You cannot use a little 5x5 centimeter photograph put in a collage. And actually this morning when I came back to London in the airport in Gatwick, I saw, you know, Sir Peter Blake, this artist. I mean, that there were 150 collages of his work in the airport and clippings, and you would see so many kinds of ways that he's been using images from other images and putting this, and well, that case just, it's, if I'd known that the judges would be so blown away by the imagery of the pornographic of the image, I don't know if we. You remember the image is about a Danish journalist where I put her face into a group sex scene just to make fun of her because she made fun of us in an article once. It was my response.
I do believe that your statement was that she makes money by fucking people. So you used her as a porn star having sex for money.
Yeah.
She fucks people by critically panning them or sucking their dick. That was your statement, right? So what did you lose for?
The judge said that they didn't take my paper into account. It was in the document, the collective document on the case, that document we wrote. But anyway,
so they were saying, so they didn't take you into account. They said that their artwork was the main artwork that needed to be protected.
Yes, and they
a piece of artwork that no one's ever seen and no one's ever spoke about, but people continually speak about your piece of artwork based upon her.
Yes, and I have legal proof now. What I do is not art. They say if it was a new, an independent, new produced artwork, and if it was a new work synthesized from earlier work, if it's, you know what I mean, it was a new independent piece of artwork, it wouldn't have been a question of.
It was an independent piece of artwork. An independent, as we said, you know, a piece of work should raise questions. You raise the question: does a journalist make their money by being an artist or by criticising other people, providing no public service or no art from their opinion? And you, your opinion on that, whether it's right or wrong, was that all the critics do are fuck people for money. And that was your statement. So in there is a clear statement of intent of an artistic expression and a question that's raised. Maybe they don't consider that art because they're used to art that just speaks to them and explains everything for them, rather than art that raises questions. That yours was a new piece of art, far more interesting than the existing piece of art that raised a question. Whether you agree, I think journalism is an art. You don't. You know, that was the question that you raised. We're here talking about whether it is or whether it isn't. So surely you're on the basis that your work has pondered thought, you know, and has created questions and debate about the role of art critics, of journalists, as opposed to that of the artist. Who is the artist there? I think it's the one that raises the questions. A journalist doesn't raise a question. A journalist tells you the answer. She makes her money by telling the answer. I think you...
Well, anyway, it didn't go so far as that. I mean, they didn't even look at that. They just said that it wasn't really about that. They said it was... The rights to the photographer of the photograph was unquestionable.
Well, then we better throw away almost all of Warhol's work and go through art history and take them all off out the galleries and smash them all to pieces, because, you know, you're not the first person to use photo montage, and surely by that ruling, no one's protected. So why did you lose the case? I still to this day don't know why you lost the case.
My personal opinion is that, well, officially I lost it because they rank the rights of a photographer's piece higher than the freedom of speech of an artist. You cannot use anybody's other people's work in a new piece of work. But my personal meaning is, my personal feeling is that the extent of the awful pornographic, misogynously, very degrading imagery towards women and the sexualization, the pornographic thing, it simply blew them away. So they couldn't keep their eyes straight on the legal issue on a photograph. That's why I wanted to promote the idea that if we put her image in a situation where she would sit in a, let's say, a field full of flowers, and I did that, then they would have been able to focus on, can you use a photograph or not? But the mere fact that I can tell you the judges, they were all white in the head when they saw this image live.
Do you think that should have anything to do with it, though? I don't think that should have anything to do with it. Do you think that they are worthy to be the deciding judge on taste?
No.
That's what you're telling me, that they were they were the judge and jury of taste. The court of taste.
And you know why I'm not appealing to the Supreme Court? Because I felt the way they even talked about it, and when you read the verdict, there will be no chance of going further. This is a foot fault by me. I should have photographed myself. I shouldn't have taken the photograph from the internet page or something. That is the big problem here. Anyway, let's go on. It's done. We tried it, and it was fun as long as it lasted.
I thought it was much more than that. I thought it was the culmination of 20 years of fuck you art lovers, where you brought the question to the masses of who are these people that we deem the judges? The judges in the court, the judges of art, the critics. Who are these people?
It
proves that they understand nothing about art, that they are not in the position to pass that judgment. Mm. The fact that they looked at the content and straight away made a ruling, rather than in the court of taste, rather than in the court of law.
It's more like we have to accept this degree of fascism. There's no way. If you fight them, are you ready to die for this and lose everything? I'm not. In the end of the day, it's just art. We still have to bring our kids to school and buy cornflakes.
I thought you said you could change people. You could change things. The man who says, we can change things with art, suddenly says, there's no hope. We must back down. We can't inflict.
We can't create any change
whatsoever, even when we're right.
Yeah, but we can change stuff if we put in our energy at the areas where it's actually accepted, and we can actually do stuff. If you're just like barking up the wrong tree, we're lost. It's really, really, it's a crazy matter.
Det er der mikrofonholder, som i dag med billedkunstner Christian von Hornslet og hans engelske makker, filminstruktør Grant Alexander. Umiddelbart lå det ikke i kortene, at de to skulle blive makkere. De fra hver sin generation, med vidt forskellig baggrund. Christian tilbragte sin ungdomsår på Herlufsholm Kostskole, mens Grant voksede op i et slumkvarter i Nordvest-London. Forskellene viser sig også i deres kunstneriske tilgang, hvor Grant griber fat i sin egen fortid, omtaler Christian altid sig selv i tredje person, når han arbejder som kunstner. Men fælles for dem begge er, at de jagter de samme historier om udemokratiske mishandlinger, udført af det brutalt engelske klassesamfund.
Next question.
What's your next move?
Well, I'm very, 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 very excited about the deep storage. You know, there's a city in Denmark called Vejle. Yeah, we talked about that. And apart from the documentarist guy filming me, Thijs Molin, from you met him, he's sick and tired of it because we agreed it should take 1 year. Now we're on the third year and he has 260 hours of tape. But anyway, I'm heading back to Vejle Kommune, which is the municipality of the city. And they're actually very close to raising the money to put up a 10 by 10 by 10 meter steel star in the city as the first land-based version of the deep storage sculpture. And when this is done, there will be funds to go to Guam and put the real one in, the real sculpture, into the ocean. It everything is on that website. Maybe we should tell the listeners this, that deepstorageproject.com. Deepstorageproject.com. It's great. Remember when we did that show at the theater in Notting Hill, where it was the first time where I really tried to use some of your not theatrical, but the skills of filmmaking into how to present stuff. Remember when I took all my artwork and crushed it into a box and put it in display? We were going to show. I think the idea was to. It was a Christmas show, and then how would you? We put ourselves this challenge. How would you show people the more the content of the art instead of the art? What was the art about? So, what did you do? Remember?
You were trying to identify what the content of the art was, and trying to make the presentation unified with the actual meaning of the work. And we decided that the work was sensational, it was cheap, it was about consumption, it was about greed. It was not like art that's timeless. It was instantly consumed and thrown away. That's why, in a way, it looks like shit, although it's beautiful. And it's instantly consumed in 1 second. Hornsliff, you know when it was made. You seemingly know what it's about. And the best way to do that was actually to destroy the art and use it as waste, and make it like a landfill of all the projects, all the Hornsliff projects that have spiraled into all types of merchandise and all types of sales, and just show it all as detritus, just squished together in one case. And to try and convey that, the meaning of the work in the performative style of how it's presented. And that's the jump off where we've tried to do things together. Is to bring more unity to the ideas.
Yeah, what I always wanted, what I found interesting in the collaboration was that, what Grant being a script writer and a filmmaker, I had really always been interested in how to make my approach to the public more clear. And as I'm a kind of instinctive animal, I just shoot to kill, and I hope to hit something out there in the dark. I'm a very unacademic approach to stuff. I was thrilled by the fact that we could create certain patterns where people could actually not explain the work to them, but more kind of give them tools to understand the work. Because sometimes I couldn't even understand myself.
Well,
remember what we tried to do when we tried to display the my work to a British audience? Because
the question that you were asking me was that you don't understand the work and you just shoot and shoot and shoot and hope that you hit something. Well, I don't think that's... For me, I can see the line that links all the things together. It appears to you like you're just doing whatever's in your mind and shooting at everything in sight. But to me, I can see the madness. And as you point out all the things that you're aiming at and all the things that you're doing, you see a unity of ideas, almost like he's giving away part of his self and exposing his, you know, part of his, the man's got issues, you know, so he's giving away some of his issues and some of his problems and some of his secrets in the things that he's attacking and pointing out and making artwork. Yeah, you've got issues, man, you've got issues, you know, and instead of you, but they're buried deep in denial and you don't see them as elements of your work until they're pointed out, when they're actually elements of yourself. If you think there's a message in Christian's work and you read it into the work, I say step back and view that message and try to see what the polar opposite of that message would be, and you'll probably find the real Christian. He exposes himself in so many ways and reveals things about himself within the work. And most people read the text. They don't read the subtext. If he says, fuck the poor, he ain't saying fuck the poor.
Don't say he. You're supposed to be talking to
We never talk about Hornsliff as in the, you know, in the first person. It's...
No, actually, when you
he refers to himself in the third person, which shows that he considers the work exterior of himself when it's not.
So you express, I express Hornsliff in third person, and you talk about Hornsliff in third person. So when you talk now, when we're not allowed to say he, we can only say you or Hornsliff from now on.
I've never heard you say I. You say Hornsliff. Like, as if there's two people inside his head, and I get to talk to Christian, and he gets to plan about...
You know what? When Iggy Pop is taking a day off, he calls himself James Osterberg. That's his real name. And he said he's always James Osterberg when he goes down with the garbage. But then he puts on the role, and I'm putting on this Hornsliff figure when I'm being Hornsliff. Can you see that?
I can see that. But I think that it's also the route... It's the freeway to your denial... But
what,
you can't
you
see
denial?
That. Yeah, oh, come on, you're full of denial.
What is denial?
You're full of denial.
Explain to me in Danish.
Without getting personal without ending up angry.
No, get personal, please.
All I'm going to say is that...
Give Peter a chance.
Anything that people think Hornsliff is saying, it's normally the complete opposite. If he says fuck the poor, he doesn't mean fuck the poor. If he says I'm going to buy these black people in Africa because they're worthless, he doesn't mean that. You know, it's the complete opposite. But rather than you know, sit there and say, you know, let's... What was it you say to me? The slogan of...
We want to help you, but we want to own you. Was that the one?
No, the whole slogan of, you know, make love, not war. It's an outdated slogan. Why say that? I would rather say, you know what? Fucking more war.
Yeah.
So then people get angry at me to have a response to it. You know, you can't fill people with hope and lovely slogans. You have to antagonise them. And almost anything that comes out of Hornsliff, because you won't refer to yourself as Hornsliff, as if he's another person in the room, tends to be the complete opposite of what people think Hornsliff is about.
So what is Hornsliff about?
There's a good heart there, really. There's a good heart there. It's not as manic and not as... If people think that he's being, that Hornsliff is, you know, being misogynistic, it's not. It's actually being very sensitive. When people think Hornsliff is being racist, Hornsliff is being open and trying to bring people in. To me, it's almost the opposite of everything that comes out of Hornsliff.
Yeah, why
difference
make the trouble people. About being opposite psychological? Why don't you go directly in and say I love you? Why do you say I hate you? What's the trouble? Why would you go that far away? The long way home.
Real men don't say I love you, do they?
No.
They struggle, which is what I said. You got issues. Mm. You got a lot of issues.
But if I should talk about myself, like 1 minute. I would say that I'm very, very interested in humor. I think it's important to laugh, and I think a great ironic guy like Kierkegaard and Lou Reed and people like that, they would have a joke while they were saying something very serious. That I thought that was the meaning about irony. Yeah.
Which is astonishing to me that, you know, the English think that they are the world leaders in irony, but they just don't get the irony when it's in front of them, you know? The irony of Hornsliff. It only seems to be the lower class that really respond to it and see it. Which is... As soon as we have these debates with in a lower class environment, they instantly understand the work has humour and they don't feel exploited. They understand that it's actually raising a question about their environment rather than mocking their environment. Whereas if you raise the question at a posh dinner party in Notting Hill, the whole room erupts with anger and fury that we would attack, you know, the democratic freedoms of this country and exploit the poor when they understand nothing about the poor or understand nothing about the democratic freedoms of the poor.
I always, what do you think about the idea that when you talk about true great art comes out of big pain and big distrust. That's why there's no big artist in Scandinavia?
Quite possibly. Which is why you came here and decided to inflict why lots
I,
of pain.
Why do I love Britain and because, you hate Britain?
Because it's full of pain. You came to Britain telling me that it was the land of opportunity, the place of capitalist dreams, and you had these funds that you were going to do this and that, and I just laughed in your face. I said, it's the place where, you know... What was it you said to me? You said, I believe in the American dream. And I said to you, the only reason you believe in it is because you're fucking asleep. Spend a bit of time here and you're going to get a wake up.
Why do you hate the UK?
Rules. Rules about everything. There's, you know, right now we're creating an environment to work out of. I've got to go through fire brigade, council, police, landlords, business rates, even though I haven't got a business. Everywhere you turn, there's somebody to put their hand in your pocket and exploit you and take your money before you're even up and moving. The system's completely rigged to take everything you've got before you have any chance of generating something for yourself.
Yeah, but if somebody must be making money, who is that? Why is somebody... How? Who's paying those guys to run after us?
This is too big a conversation to have right now, but in this country, you've got... the most pointless jobs. Today I saw a site manager who was employed to be the head of visual decoration outside on the street. I don't know what this job is. They're on £30,000 a year to stand there and judge whether the street looks pretty, if the lines are painted, if the signs are posted right. This is insane. And you have all these levels of bureaucracy put in place just so somebody's got a job, so it appears that there's a job. You know, I've had to go through 50 different people. This is not going to make it, but I've gone through 50 different people to get permission to fit a door. In Denmark, you would just knock out the door and get it signed off by an official regulation company. I've gone through 50 people to knock for a door. They've told me I'm going to have to wait 9 months to knock a door for a building that I own. You know, you've got to have a license to take a shit in this country. Mm. You've got to apply to the council before you can take a shit. You've got to apply to the government and file 20 different pieces of documentation before they agree for you to have your own right to take a dump in your own place.
What do you actually like about this country?
Misery. We're the most miserable, moody people.
How can that because be it's positive?
Because it produces great art, produces great writers, great filmmakers. That's about the only thing I've got good to say.
Would you like to stay here forever?
No.
Do you feel proud when you think about I'm British? Is there anything you can say about the pride of this country?
Proud to be British? I'm appalled to be British. I'm appalled to be British. You know? For example, we've just flooded Syria with weapons. And now... We're saying we need to go in for humanitarian aid. You know, we've just come...
We can't talk anymore. The interview is over.
I'm going to keep talking anyway. We've come out of Afghanistan, we've come out of Iraq, and we've gone straight into Libya and Syria.
My weapon shares are rising.
And we've blown the shit out of both, and now we're saying we need to go in because the people need us. We've flooded it and turned it... The same people we spent 10 years fighting, terrorists, we're funding to go into Libya and Syria. And the English people are so fucking docile that they take everything that is told to them by the world's most prestigious news organisation, the BBC, at face value. And they take it at face value and they say, oh yes, we were fighting terrorism, but now there's another problem. The problem is the same problem, we're just funding it this time. And the people turn around and go, yeah, that's fine. I'm appalled to be British. I'm ashamed of everything that's British. During the Olympics, I left the country. It was like, you know, Nazis all over again, waving the flags. It was like...
super nationalism.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have to go now. We're gonna continue talking after the microphone is closed.
Turn it off. I'm angry.
Yeah. Thank you. Good night, America.
Mikrofonholder var med billedkunstner Christian von Hornslet og hans engelske makker, filminstruktør Grant Alexander. Programmet var tilrettelagt af Julie Ting og produceret af Line Fabricius for Mikrofon.